Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
Hey everybody, I'm Michael Steele. Today I am joined by Ellie Mastal. He is the nation's legal analyst and justice correspondent, and the author of a new book, which opens with the sentence, "Our Constitution is not good." Oh, you know we're going to get into that ish. The book is Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. It's out now. He's a frequent guest on MSNBC where I get to hang out. And today, he's coming to hang out with me here on the Michael Steele Podcast. We'll be back with our conversation with Ellie Mastal right after this.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
What's up, baby? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It is such a treat. Having you on is always fun. And, you know, this conversation we're about to have, brother, about this book, as I told you when we were sort of offline talking, I'm sitting there arguing with every page turner here. It is a great read, folks. I can't wait for you to get into it. A Black Man's Guide to the Constitution. Allow me to retort. That's what the brother said. Let him do it. So, man, welcome. So, there's so many places I want to begin with you on this book, because first off, before we get into some of the meat of it, what I loved about this, and to be rather frank about it, this is the first time I've read something about our founding document written from the perspective of someone from the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
I do.
Look, I mean, and the thing about it is, folks, y'all need to understand, it ain't wild out crazy shit either. I mean, this is straight line constitutional reasoning, application of law to facts and narrative, but it brings a different perspective and interpretation. How did you synthesize that? What made you kind of move into that door, go through that door versus the more traditional route? Because you're a lawyer, your background, you could do the white man approach all day long if you needed to, but you didn't.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's great to kind of be here and be arguing with liberal versus conservative within the confines of liberal democracy, as
right.
we used to.
What a
as
concept.
My dad once did. Right?
Who thought of doing that shit?
Remember those days? Yeah, so look, the book is called A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. It's not called A Guide to the Constitution for Black People, right? And that switch is important. All I'm trying to do, as you rightly point out, is to talk about this document from the perspective of a person who it was designed to ignore and, in fact, enslave, right? And so the entire way that we look at this document is different when I remember what they actually said about me in this document, when I remember that they said that I was three-fifths of a person, when they remember that they said that I could be captured and returned to my master, even if I made it all the way to freedom. I think about the founding fathers and their project a little differently when I remember what that project meant for people who looked like me. And so when you talk about synthesizing kind of that perspective with, you know, classic Harvard-educated, Harvard-trained legal analysis, it's what I've been trying to do my whole life, right? I'm the kid in law school. So Michael, you'll appreciate this story. So I basically go to law school because in high school, Antonin Scalia made fun of me.
It got personal.
Right, exactly. I was in Knoxville, as one does, and you know, my team makes it to nationals. We don't win, but we made it to nationals in DC. And one of the judge for the final round that I got to watch, I wasn't a part of it, was Antonin Scalia. So after the, you know, whatever, there's the meeting with, you know, the auditorium hall with Scalia and, you know, 150 would be like high school nerd kids, right?
Right.
And he takes questions for the audience. And I raise my hand.
Of course
you do. And I ask what I think is a very good question. How do you synthesize? I didn't use that word. How do you understand the need to overcome segregation, to outlaw segregation in Brown v. Board of Ed? How do you square that with your originalist ideas that we should always look to what the founders say? For a 17-year-old, it's pretty good.
Pretty damn good. Right? At 17, I was like, what's the address for the party?
And that dude laughed at me.
No, he did not.
Laughed at me, and he goes, is this what you're teaching your kids? Never answered my question.
Of course he couldn't.
Right? And then of course, like, it's high school, right? So then all the other kids laughed at me. I'm the kid that got laughed at by Antonin Scalia. Man, right there, I was just like, No, I'm gonna learn how to ask this.
Wow.
I'm gonna get my answer.
But you got him in the moment. He didn't answer your question.
He couldn't, because there is a way to square it. And as if you've read the book, like I basically give what Scalia's answer should have been to me in the moment, but it's complicated, right? So he couldn't kind of one off in a funny way answer my question. So instead of saying like, oh, you know, son, there is some tension there or whatever, he just blew me off, right? But it goes to answer your question.
And his brother then decided to go to law school.
You shouldn't have messed with me, because I would have gone to business school and made money. but when I'm now in law school and when I'm going through my career and profession, I'm always kind of thinking basically of that black kid that I was. I'm thinking about this, like, how do you explain, how do you justify, how do you interpret what America has done from the perspective of young people who understand, what's the word I'm looking for? From the perspective of a community who understands that this country is aligned against them more often than it's aligned for them.
So let's get into the meat of our discussion then, because you had me screaming on page one. But actually, it was on page two, because and folks, that's the introduction. I hadn't even gotten into the story, the narrative that he wanted to play out there. You start off and you rightly say, the Constitution is an imperfect work that urgently and consistently needs to be modified and reimagined to make good on its unrealized promises of justice and equality for all. Okay, there's a fair point. There will be those who argue, certainly from my camp, that, well, you don't want to go tinkering where you don't need to go tinkering, because like your grandmama used to say, you don't want to go there. You don't want to do that, right? Okay, but that's a reasonable point. You go on though, and you say, you make the point on page two, quote, at no point with emphasis have people of color or women been given a real say in how it, the Constitution, was written, interpreted, or amended. Even the amendments that granted equal rights to minorities and women were written by white men. Okay, fair, accurate historic point. How do you then square that with your general theme as you open up the conversation? That, and you really said it at the beginning, that the Constitution is not good. And then in fact, because Black people didn't have a hand in writing it, which you say on page two, my question is, would they have written something different?
Yes, first of all, great question. Thank you so much. Because so much of the conversation since I've been on this book tour has been with the first clause, right? The Constitution is trash. Not all of the other clauses,
right?
Where I tried it. So I'm very happy to be able to talk about, like, I'm very happy you made it to page two, because most of my interviews have been about page one.
Right? Folks, so, I'm telling you, that's to give you an inkling about this book.
So I do, in fact, think that if you had asked the enslaved people at the time, in 1865, in 1868, what freedom, equality, fairness, and justice looked like for them, I think there's an excellent chance that instead of simply saying the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause, they might have added something about housing. They might have added something about equal pay. There were, you know, if you go back and look at what a Frederick Douglass was arguing for, and Frederick Douglass was a fan of the Constitution, right?
Yeah, he was
arguing for more than political equality. He was arguing for an aspect of social equality. That social equality was almost completely overlooked by the Reconstruction amendments. And in fact, you could make a good argument that the Reconstruction amendments wouldn't have passed muster with white people if the white people in real time had thought they were conferring social equality to the formerly enslaved race. So yes, I think there's a great argument. You know, we can't know because, you know, the slavers weren't polling us back then, but like there's a
they were polling us, but it was a different kind of poll,
right? but there's an argument to be made that an idea of equality might have been quite different if it included everybody. And I'll also say, if it had included the poor white men of 1865, who were thrown out and not consulted when talking about the Reconstruction Amendments, right? So the first actual lawsuit, I talk about this in the book, the first actual lawsuit under the 13th and 14th Amendments is by white people arguing in the slaughterhouse cases. It was basically, they were butchers, right? And the government of Louisiana had granted a monopoly to one butcher. And so all of these independent butchers then had to basically work for the big butcher. And they're like, that's wrong. And they argued under the 13th Amendment's forced labor, because these are butchers that have to work now for the big butcher, and under the 14th Amendment's grant of due process, that they were being discriminated against. These white butchers argued that they were being discriminated against in their economic rights. And the conservative court said, yeah, no, we're just not going to do that. We're just not. The Reconstruction Amendments only count for the slave race. That's their words, not mine. Mm-hmm. Only count for the slave race, and it doesn't include economic rights, and get the hell out of my courtroom. So even if he had talked to poor white people in 1865,
they would
have
agreed.
It's very likely that the Reconstruction Amendments look completely different they actually look.
So, Professor, should our Constitution embody healthcare, housing, rights as rights that are ultimately decided and regulated at the state level? In other words, did we do this a little bit ass backwards as a nation, where a lot of our European countries, to the extent that they have constitutions, most do, they kind of set forth some of these rights. You have a right to health care. You know, where the state will provide you health care. What was it about us that we look at those things and say, I'm sorry, New York, Massachusetts, Alabama, Virginia, y'all decide. The federal government is not, we will arbitrate any disputes, but you decide. What was it that triggered us to look at the things you've just described as outside of the Constitution?
It was federalism, right? The idea.
Glad you went there. You read my mind, brother. Go ahead.
The idea that we are a conglomeration of independently sovereign states, as opposed to one nation with different provinces.
Which is how the European how Europe is set up. It's why they still have a problem with the EU. Right.
With a bunch of provinces which have different levels of home rule. We're set up as individual entities, individual sovereign entities that have conglomerated or confederated, and I don't mean that in the racist way, confederated into a whole, right? That is why, and that to me is the poison pill of the entire Constitution. That is, from my perspective, that is why so many of the things that don't work here don't work, because we thought we have our rights flow up from the states, not flow up from the people, I will say, not flow up from the people who are living here, but flow up from the states as an entity, as opposed to flow up from
the people are the ones
from the federal government.
But Ellie, the people are the ones who are electing representatives who are putting in place what they want, ostensibly, correct? I mean, that's flowing up. I mean, that's how you have this state is pro this particular issue. That state is not that issue. And to the extent,
because here's
but the point is that there is something to that federalism that says that us here in Maryland versus you over in Virginia, y'all do what y'all want to do, we do what we want to do, and we only need to speak to each other at such time as there's a conflict between what we're doing. And that's where the courts would come in.
So, first we have to remember why we have that system, right?
Right.
And that's the reason why we have that system is because us here in Maryland didn't want to have slaves and us here in Virginia totally did. So the reason why we decided to organize ourselves this way was in fact because of the slave question and that compromise that, I mean, I think, only the
That's
most
right.
avid that people do mm-hmm. not understand that the Constitution is a compromise document. That's
of course it
why
is.
It looks the way it is. That compromise worked so swimmingly that less than 100 years later, we got into a hot civil war over it, right? It's kind of a demerit to me.
I would take an exception. I don't think we got into a hot civil war over the Constitution. I think we got into a hot civil war over the economics of it. Because at the end of the day, the state felt that its economic interest was ultimately infringed upon. But I get your point where you're saying the states are saying, I'm sorry, you can't own that chattel. You exactly. can't have that property. So therefore, that's how it strikes at your economic interest.
Exactly. Like that chattel that you had when you were in Virginia no longer should exist when you're in Maryland. No.
Right.
This is our conflict, right? So that's kind of so let's never forget why federalism is here to me in the first place. But then the second issue that you, I think, rightly bring up is there are some benefits. There are, especially in a country that spans a continent, you kind of understand the idea that the laws and rights and responsibilities that work in Texas are not going to be the same laws and rights and responsibilities that work in Rhode Island. They're just too
right.
They've got to be treated two different ways. And that works to me so long as there are fundamental protections for human rights that because human rights do not care if you're living in Rhode Island or Texas, and that there are fundamental protections for voting rights, because voting rights don't care if you live in Rhode Island or Texas.
Right.
However, That's not how we've done it. So that the idea that what you have to do, even before you get into voter suppression and the racist history about that and blah, blah, blah. The idea to me that the way that you have to go about participating in the polity, participating in politics in Texas is radically different than how you have to go about participating in politics in Rhode Island, which is radically different than how you go about participating in politics in Oregon.
Right.
It's just insane. It doesn't actually make sense. It's an anachronistic callback to a time when these states thought of themselves as independent sovereign entities, only begrudgingly entering into union, as opposed to an acknowledgement of where we are in modern society. And it's why every other country doesn't work like ours, right? So that's beyond the European style, right? Canada doesn't do it like this.
Right.
Mexico doesn't do it like this. Ivory Coast doesn't do it like this. Japan doesn't do it like this. It's beyond Europe. Like, we are an outlier in having rights of citizenship flow up from different principalities as opposed to flow out from a centralized government.
Yeah, that's what we wanted to get away from. Because the centralized government was actually, hurting my game. Was hurting my individual rights. It was controlling through its taxation and through its abuse, if you will, my ability to realize whatever I want my British dream to be, or my European dream to be.
I think that's an interesting 18th century argument, but here in the 21st century,
did he just insult me? I'm not.
I think we can agree.
I think he just called me old, like really dirt old. But okay,
Michael, can I bring up the South African example? Right?
Oh, dude, this is you and me. You can bring up whatever you want.
Because look at other ways that we could have done this, right? So South Africa, they had an apartheid constitution, right? The Afrikaans Boer constitution allowed for what? It was all about apartheid, home rule. I can make an analogy between South African home rule and the United States Senate. I won't here today out of friendship. But,
From DC, but all right.
right. Some might say that DC and Soweto have something in common, just
very much so.
Right. Others might not. I'm just going to throw that out there. But the bottom line is that
I'm for home rule, by the way.
What?
I'm for home rule, but go ahead.
Okay. The bottom line is that South Africa had a bad constitution, right? And then Nelson Mandela gets free, Matt Damon wins a rugby match, and now we are into the modern age. What does South Africa do at that point? Do they just update their Afrikaans constitution with a couple of amendments? No. They start over. They throw the Afrikaans constitution out. They have a whole new constitutional convention. This one, including all of the people, including the black people who weren't allowed to have a say or a voice in the Afrikaans constitution. They include women, and they come up with a new document. And it's the South African constitution that is one of the best written constitutions in the world right now for its protection of human rights. Now, South Africa still has quite a lot of home rule, right? So like what goes on in Cape Town is different than what goes on in Joburg and what have you. But there are fundamental rights to equality, to housing, to justice and fairness that can't be taken away just because you happen to be living in Soweto versus Cape Town versus Johannesburg.
But that's great for South Africa. That would be like Texas doing that, all right? But if you're talking about the African continent, I dare say you would have a very different conversation in the sense that if you, very much like the Europeans under the European Union, if you try to constitutionalize that association and that relationship, it becomes a lot much more gnarly in the process to do it today than to have done it 200 years ago. Number one. So, right. You give me that. So in your estimation, you would look at our constitution as not only being flawed, in its origin, but also in its construction and its subsequent construction, the amendments and interpretation.
Yeah, I think that there are two kinds of flaws in the Constitution, right? And one flaw is structurally, right? We structurally, because of the federalism that we've talked about, because of the equal suffrage in the Senate, right? That fundamentally locks in minority rule so that we have a voter in Wyoming being worth 58 voters in California when it comes to presidential power. Our lack right. of direct election of our president, right? The fact that, you know, one of the founding flaws of our country that doesn't get talked about enough is that the founders thought that political parties wouldn't be a thing. I mean, George Washington,
they were hoping they wouldn't be addressed. Right.
Like, you know, the political parties are the worst thing ever, and we should never have it, right?
They were right.
But it means that the Constitution has no, because they were so like, we're not going to have political parties, the Constitution has no protection for political parties, has no protection for minority parties or majority parties. It doesn't say anything about what parties can or cannot do. There are no limits on them, is my point, right?
And that's fine. We left it to the states to decide that. And in fact, when you look at the structure, the organization of the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, I know some friends on my side are right now who say the Republican National Committee is in violation of its own charter because it has no platform.
Right. But the problem with what you're saying is that we've left it to the states is that the real issue here is that we didn't address constitutionally the scourge of gerrymandering, right? So like you can make an argument.
What the hell were you gerrymandering in 1882 or 1820?
What were you?
Yeah, it was just like Virginia was like one big place.
Well, but this is my point, right? Gerrymandering didn't matter very much in the 1800s right. when only one kind of person could vote.
Right? Fair point.
They weren't concerned about minority representation because only one people could vote. Only right. the liberal bourgeoisie class could vote in the 1800s, right? The lack of constitutional protections and just guidance on gerrymandering now means that in the 21st century, when everybody arguably can vote, it allows for the powerful people to effectively take the right of vote away from disadvantaged minorities in their state. And I'm sure you've heard me say this, like the gerrymandering that happens in New York to me is just as bad as the gerrymandering that happens in Alabama. This is one of the few things where I will brook some both sides of them. Both sides do engage in gerrymandering. In my book, I talk about how my dad and Rick Lazio, former Republican candidate for Senate, gerrymandered Long Island in a meeting.
Right.
Like, that's a story in my book, right? So literally both sides do this kind of stuff, and there's no constitutional guidance or protections around it, and that's just a flaw. That's just an oversight, and we can talk about these people as if they're venerated like on high. Let's remember, besides the slavery, besides the colonization, besides the rich liberal bourgeoisiness of them, they were 30-year-olds. I mean, like, we are literally trying to...
Yeah, we do see them as being a lot older than they actually were.
Right? They were 30 when they wrote this. This is like having Zac Efron and Justin Bieber
right?
come together and tell you how government's going to work for the next 250 years.
You raise an interesting point. So who the hell do you think would be writing the Constitution that, you know, taking the South African example... Who do you think would be writing that constitution should we have a constitutional convention? I would propose AOC on the left and Marjorie Taylor Greene on the right.
Oh my God, if we could actually have, look, I am not for a constitutional convention, not because I'm afraid of AOC and MTG. It's because the people who would pick the delegates, they would pick them along the same kind of broken corporatist racially biased lines as we have already, right? So you would still have a situation where Wyoming would have one delegate and California would have one delegate, as opposed to Wyoming having one delegate and California having 58, right? If we could have true popular representation in the Constitutional Convention, I would be for it. But that's not how it worked. It would be a Constitutional Convention brought to you by the Koch brothers and Disney. And
or George Soros
or the George whoever you would think I'm liberal.
I mean, he's the liberal go to. So I just
met Leonard Leo.
Leonard Leo. There you go.
So there's that, right? So I'm not for an actual constitutional convention, not because I'm worried about AOC or MTG, right. But because I don't trust. We are too infused with the same corporate money that has dogged other attempts at reform. So instead of that, I try to lean into the justocracy, right? Like if the Supreme Court is going to claim supremacy over what is and is not constitutional, which A, is not in the Constitution. That is just, the Supreme Court just decided in 1803 that it had the power to declare acts of Congress unconstitutional. Nobody wrote that. Nobody thought that. That was just Chief
Justice. But if not then who?
Well,
so the court was actually right in making that. I mean, if anything, someone has got to sit in judgment, strong word, maybe arbitration, of the laws that are passed by the Congress. The executive branch is not going to be in effect.
Well, we could do it like every other Western industrialized country does it.
But we're not.
But we could be.
Why would we be?
Because maybe they have ideas that we should look at, right? So like you don't have the Canadian Supreme Court overruling Parliament. That's ridiculous, right? You have in other Western industrialized countries.
So who decides what's constitutional?
Are there to arbitrate conflicts of laws. President says this, Congress says that. Okay, now we need a court to arbitrate the winner. What we don't have, what we don't see in other countries is laws passed by the Parliament signed by the prime minister, or laws passed by their legislature, signed by their executive, being overturned by a third branch of unelected,
so
unaccountable officials.
In that
does not happen in other places.
But
because the idea that the nine people who currently sit on the Supreme Court have their power for life, which thanks to Pfizer is like super long now, right? Have their power for life, are unaccountable to the people, and nobody voted for them in a democratic republic. That's just dumb. That's just not how we should do it.
Look, I have mixed views on the Supreme Court, but I do want to.
Yeah, you're a conservative. You're supposed to be like activist judges are the. Are the things
no, I look, they're activist judges, on both sides of that coin. I don't like the con. I get that there's a little bit of activism built into the system because that's human nature. You can't escape human nature. I'm sorry, you can't even escape your politics. In fact, there's a section of the book we're gonna get into when we come back from our break, because I just spoke on that last night, as a matter of fact. one of the sections of your book. But before we go to that, Brick, I do want to sort of lay on the table the example you gave of other nations that have this system where you have, you know, the executive branch does this and the legislature does that. And then the court sort of says, all right, guys, work it out. So what happens when there's an action by the state that an individual challenges or that their action is challenged by the state, who then arbitrates whether or not that's constitutional? Do they then say, oh, we got to go back and rewrite the law because, you know, I'm sorry, you know, this family over here was wronged. And so now we got to rewrite the law. Well, you'd be rewriting that law a hell of a lot, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, the experience of other nations is that you don't have to rewrite the law every time, because occasionally legislatures are going to get it wrong, right? There's going to be a principle that they violate, right? And then when they violate that principle, the court just says, well, we're going to make it right. We're going to not have the family suffer that consequence. We're going to make a make good payment back. We don't say that the whole law is broken. We say that every time this law operates this way, this is what the court's going to do, and then leave it to the legislature to figure out how to fix its law so that stops happening, right? So a great example for this to me would be something like what SB 8 is doing with abortion in Texas, right? Like, if we think of abortion rights as constitutional, and I know that's a different thing that I don't want to get into right now.
But
let's just say that for the moment, for the sake of the argument, that abortion is a constitutional right. Well, then Texas goes off and says, like, actually, no, we're going to have bounty hunters and whatever. Well, what the courts would do in that situation, as opposed to just saying, coming in and saying, well, like, SB 8 is clearly unconstitutional. I, by the way, believe that it's clearly unconstitutional. It's just that they would refuse to enforce SB 8 because it's clearly unconstitutional and wait for the Texas legislature to figure it out and write something new, right? So you don't have to take the laws away if the court simply won't enforce unconstitutional laws or principles. I know it sounds like a dodge, but it really, but what I
know is no, it does, it's not a dodge. In fact, it's actually probably in 1803 what the court should have done.
Yes. It's how the courts were intended to work. Remember, Federalist 78, which is before you go to break, the last thing I'll think.
Yes.
Federalist 78, right? So this is James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay writing about how the Constitution should be interpreted. Remember, they're arguing against amendments at this point, right?
That's right.
Against the anti-federalists, right? And so Hamilton in Federalist 78 says that the Supreme Court is the least dangerous branch, because it has neither the purse nor the army. So basically that both branches can ignore the Supreme Court whenever it does something stupid. And that's arguably what Hamilton and Jay thought would happen.
That didn't turn out right.
Right? Like Hamilton, I said in my book, the next time Hamilton would be as wrong, he would be shooting his gun in the air Burr killed him. Like that, that's that level of mistake that he
totally
made.
Totally misunderstanding the moment. It's like, dude, you're at a duel.
Right?
You don't shoot up.
No, bro.
Aim.
Power we are having a
yeah, exactly. We're having a great conversation with my friend who's got a new book out. Ellie Mistal's got the book called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. It is out now. I'm going to highly recommend. If you are enjoying any of this conversation, you're probably online already ordering this book, because it is that good. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more with Ellie right after this.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. Are you tired of the corporate-controlled media ignoring the needs of we the people? You know, the people who actually do the work? Are you tired of the platitudes that they throw at us? Remember when they called us patriotic, frontline heroes, essential, only to find out that they've lined their pockets with the fruits of our sacrifice and labor? Had enough? It's time to come together, organize, and unite. Join us at The Rick Smith Show daily by downloading the podcast each and every day. Subscribe so you never miss a minute. The Rick Smith Show podcast is found wherever you get your podcasts, from iTunes to iHeart, Stitcher to Podbean, and beyond. Go to TheRickSmithShow.com for more information on how you can get the podcast each and every day. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. So those of you who've never been to con law classes, you're getting a little taste of what a good con law class is like. And when you have a good professor who's not only knowledgeable and insightful, but willing to sort of yank your chain and give you some chain to work with, it's all good. And that's my man, Ellie Mistal. The beginning of the book to me sort of set such a great tone. So when I was getting into the later chapters, I was more than fired up. But you in the section where you're talking about canceling trash people is not a constitutional crisis. You make the note at one point that I responded to, around cancel culture. You said, quote, the real cancel culture is the one practiced by conservatives. They are the ones leading the assault on the First Amendment and freedom of speech. Actually, I'm not going to disagree with that so much, and particularly how they play that out. How does the whole cancel culture piece fit in a constitutional context with the First Amendment? Because keeping in mind that the First Amendment is about government action against your right to speech, not private action. And what you're seeing here are Republicans going after those in the private sector, or at least I guess threatening is where your linchpin is. They're threatening the use of federal power, government power, to chill speech. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So how's a good way of getting into this? Let's start here. Why did they want the First Amendment in the first place? Right? Like, why is that
right?
Right? And it's so you have the right to political speech. It's so you have the right to criticize the king without ending up in the brig. It's so you have the right to criticize the government. Then it's so you have the right to publish a newspaper. A lot of these founding fathers and revolutionaries were newspaper men. That was how information was disseminated. For the kids listening at home, newspapers used to be like TikTok is today.
It's yeah.
Kind of like how you got information. It was like the Graham of the 18th century, right?
he's right.
Well, I was like, my kids, like my 9-year-old has no idea what a newspaper is. right? And then they were concerned about religious freedom, right? They wanted the ability to practice their faith in the privacy of their own home without the king coming in and saying, no, you can't do that. No, you're wrong, right? So this is why the First Amendment is there. Stop me when you get to the point where I say the First Amendment is there so that Roseanne Barr can have a television show. Right? Because it's just not, right? The First Amendment is not is not there so that you can get an endorsement contract, so that you can get tenure. That's not why the First Amendment is there either. So when you think about speech, you have to think about the kinds of speech that they were most interested in protecting. And that's political speech, that's the press, and that's religious speech. That's what they're most interested in protecting. So when you look at what Republicans are doing right now, what they're trying to do is to use state power to stop people from reading books they don't like, from talking about, I don't even know how to put it, from talking about sexual orientations that make them uncomfortable.
Right.
And they're trying to use the powers of the state to do that. That is something the First Amendment would care about. When you look at the so-called cancel culture on the left, and I don't really think that it's a thing, but whatever, for the sake of the argument, when you look at the so-called cancel culture on the left, what you have are people trying to vote with their wallets against comedians that make jokes they don't like, right?
Right.
So like the difference between Ron DeSantis saying that you cannot teach this in a classroom versus, I don't know, me saying we shouldn't buy tickets to Louis C.K.'s new comedy special. It's different in, by the way, I think Louis C.K. is hilarious. It's just unfortunate that he's a terrible masturbator. It's different in kind, right? Like I'm saying, like here's a market-based economic solution to say keep it in your pants, Louis C.K. versus DeSantis is saying take that book and throw it in the trash in school. Like what is that?
Let's right.
Two completely different things. In the book, I bring up the threat of lawsuits, the way that rich white people have used the lawsuits to chill an independent press. Right? It's Peter Thiel coming after Gawker through a series of harassing lawsuits, eventually catching a victory with the Hulk Hogan case, right? That's a threat to the First Amendment. The founding fathers didn't want the freedom of the press to be impinged by things like, you know, state-sponsored lawsuits, right? So these are the concerns that I have when it comes to cancel culture, not, again, the endorsement potential of R. Kelly, right? Like, it's just... Those are just two different things.
Right. So I had a lot of fun actually was when you talked in the chapter, bigotry is illegal even if you've been ordered to by Jesus.
Yeah.
And and so I want to get, and I'm going to try very hard not to get too law schoolish here and two lawyers going back and forth, because you have a clear edge. I was a corporate guy, right? So you know where my ultimate interests were going to lie, right? So
you and my wife could have a conversation about structured products, and
there we go. You know, there we go. That's what I'm talking about. But you start in this in this section talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. And I remember the passage of RFRA, and I remember the case that involved RFRA, that RFRA was born out of, the Employment Division versus Smith, where the court essentially changed the interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. Okay, mm-hmm. And that set off for you apparently the idea that what Clinton administration and Democrats in cahoots with Republicans essentially did was to strip away that portion of the First Amendment, and that opened up the door in a way that allowed sort of religious zeal to sort of take greater hold.
So walk us through
that a little bit, because it's funny, you said in here, there are laws and customs throughout our system that are inextricably tied to Christian theology. I was just at Syracuse University last night and gave a lecture on aspects of that in terms of the intersection of faith and politics, and how, as a Roman Catholic, there are aspects of my faith that I brought into decisions that I had to address as lieutenant governor of my state, one of them being the death penalty. And as someone who is pro-life consistently, I am anti-death penalty and pro-life in the context of the unborn, making the case to save the life of those individuals who were about to die in my state on death row, that there was that Christian theology that sort of animated some of the reasoning around that. So in one sense, that's not a bad thing. It's when it becomes, as we've seen in many cases, more frequently than should be, a zealousness to that. And that, I would say, and as you, I'm gonna let you get into this, I would say that absent RFRA, all right, absent the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the outcome in Employment Division versus Smith, and the outcome in Holly Lobby would have been exactly the same. That they're bookends. RFRA changes. So if you just go back. And in one case, in Employment Division, you have someone who used peyote as part of a religious service, but that peyote is an illegal substance. And the state said, you do not have an interest here. We have a greater interest here to prevent you from using this substance, right? In Holly Lobby, you have the state coming in and saying to someone that we have a greater interest for you to impose, to change your healthcare plan to include birth control, even though you claim it's against your religious convictions. My point is, the courts would have gotten that, the courts got both of those cases right, and RFRA was just an interloper because you came out to the same result. So, Professor, it's all yours.
All right, but I think the courts got Employment Division v. Smith right, and Hobby Lobby Wrong.
Okay.
Because of RFRA, right? So here's how I'll do it. Let's go back to the actual facts of the case of Employment Division v. Smith, because they're hilarious, right? They're two Native Americans who are working for a drug like rehab clinic, right?
That is a good case.
Right? Who are taking peyote, right? Because of their religious
drug rehab case. Yeah, right? Yeah.
So they get fired from their drug rehab clinic, as well as they probably should.
For using drugs.
Right, which is not, so I don't have a problem with them getting fired from that, even though I understand it's a religious ceremony and I'm not trying to, harsh on.
You're not all pining on that, right?
Right, like I understand why you can't work for a drug rehab clinic and you take drugs on this. You can't do that, fine, right? But then these guys, they applied for unemployment.
Right.
And it's the unemployment benefits that said, well, like you can't get unemployment if you're on drugs. Well, right. that to me is the ridiculous conservative Victorian bullcrap, right? Like, who says you can't get unemployment? Why should you not be able to get unemployment?
Because the thinking is,
I know what you're going to say. I know.
I'm just saying, but that's the social construct that the government is there to either allow or protect against, and the rationale is that, okay, you're working in a drug rehab center using drugs. You get fired from that place of employment. Now you want unemployment benefits. And the rationale, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but the rationale is no, because you're going to use those unemployment benefits to do what?
More drugs.
More drugs.
Maybe. I think you should get unemployment benefits because you're unemployed. Like that should be.
No, I agree with that. That's the slippery slope in some of these narratives when the federal government decides or the state decides that how it's determining its interest, the degree of its interest in this matter. Right. If you just stop at what you just said, we don't have an issue. But then what happens is they start projecting all the shit you may or may not do with that money. And then what if they decided I'm just going to go buy a TV? So I'm going to watch, stories about drugs on TV. I'm not going to go buy any. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So how do you know what they're going to do with the money? But anyway, go ahead.
Right. So the court said that all of this was fine. That of course they could get fired because of course they could get fired. And of course they could be denied unemployment benefits because the law saying that you couldn't do drugs and get unemployment benefits was religion neutral. It doesn't matter if what religion you are, you just can't, it doesn't have a special exception if your religion is a drug using religion or whatever. So then RFRA comes in. So then the Democrats see this decision and they come over the top with a new law submitted to to Congress by my boy Chuck Schumer, sponsored in the Senate by my boy Ted Kennedy, signed into law by my triangulation boy Bill Clinton, right? This is a Democrat idea. Republican support, voice vote in the House and whatever, like, everybody loved this law. Like,
hallelujah.
Right? And it was that the courts had to change their tests to take these minor religious ideas seriously, right? That they had to give the peyote people an exception because they were practicing their faith. And so they should still be able to get unemployment benefits because all they were doing was practicing their faith. Now, again, the way that I would have solved this was not to change the religious laws, the laws on how we understand religion. It would be to change the laws on how we understand unemployment. But Democrats went towards the religion side, and so now we have RFRA. So now Hobby Lobby comes up, right?
Right.
And now the issue in Hobby Lobby is the corporate entity not wanting to give drugs to its employees. The drugs were birth control, but whatever. Not wanting to give drugs to their employees because it violated the corporation's, not the employees', religious freedom. Mm-hmm. And the court under RFRA said that's absolutely correct. And so now because of what RFRA has done, the corporate entity can deny drugs, and again, I'm using drugs with scare quotes on them because we're talking about birth control, but can deny drugs to their employees because of their religious objections. If he had just done what I said in the 90s and just changed the unemployment laws, then both the peyote people would be able to get their unemployment and the women working at Hobby Lobby would be able to get their birth control. But because
I don't think the women at Hobby Lobby would have been able to get their birth control. I think you would have still, the court still would have looked at that and said that the state does not have a greater interest here. The state cannot show that, as how did you put it in here? You said that they were very, 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 you know, good reasons to impose this ruling on them. I don't think a liberal court or a conservative court would have interpreted that the interests of the state trumped the religious freedom rights of the First Amendment rights of Hobby Lobby.
I just disagree about that. I think that absent RFRA, I think that even a conservative court, because remember, Scalia is still alive at this point. Scalia was really all about secular law trumping religious law, except for the places where Scalia kind of couldn't get through his own bigotry, right? So like, so in the gay rights context, Scalia never could just, he couldn't see that.
Right.
But in lots of other religious cases, Scalia generally was a person who sided with the secular law trumping religious freedom, because again, I also remember what used to happen. This, I try to explain this in the book because it's important. It's important to, for people to understand how the Overton window has shifted on the issue of religious freedom.
Yes.
What it used to be was practitioners of minority faiths, right? It used to be the peyote natives, you know, whatever. It used to be Muslims. It used to be people, you know, the Amish, right? It used to be small minority religions arguing for exceptions to otherwise secular laws, arguing that those laws might sound secular, but actually lock in a lot of Judeo-Christian traditions in their laws, right? That used to be where the debate was. And so the conservative position used to be, no, we're gonna ignore these minority religions. We're gonna just have regular secular laws. And if that happens to benefit Catholics, oh well. If that happens to benefit Protestants, oh well, right?
Like South Africa, my friend, we've evolved.
Right. Now what we have is people in the majoritarian religions, mm-hmm. in the Judeo-Christian traditions, in the Protestant Catholic traditions, arguing that otherwise secular laws impinge on their religious freedom. So a law simply saying that you have to provide health care to your employees that has nothing to do with religion now impinges on my religious freedom,
right?
As I'm the majoritarian Judeo-Christian religion. That's been the change in my lifetime. I mean, literally, Employment Division B. Smith is 1991. That's been the change that's happened in my lifetime in terms of how we are having this debate right now. And I think that, you know, as I say in the book, anytime I'm passing a law and I'm getting voice vote support from Republicans, I'm like, whoa, whoa, what am I not thinking about? What did I not see about how this could go the other way?
The other way, right. So before I let you get out of here, I got two very easy areas of the Constitution I want you to cover for folks. The Second and the Eighth Amendment. I think
that's simple.
I think you can knock that out in less than 3 minutes. No, but we all know the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the Eighth Amendment reads, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Speak to the Second Amendment as a standalone on its own, because we know all the ish that's wrapped up into that. But then the Eighth Amendment specifically on a subject that, again, as I've already indicated, is important to me, in the death penalty and its application to impose the death penalty as to prevent the death penalty.
Right. So the Second Amendment, the quick and dirty version of it is that the current idea that the Second Amendment protects the right to for gun ownership for personal self-defense, that was invented by the NRA in the 70s. That's not the original understanding of the Second Amendment. The original understanding of the Second Amendment was all about the well-regulated militias, because the reason why the anti-federalists wanted the Second Amendment was that the well-regulated militias was how those people put down slave revolts.
Right.
Like my family's from, my people go back to Haiti. We know something about a slave revolt, right? Like we know what can happen. And what it means is that when you have, the only way that you can keep people in bondage against their will is to have a numerical advantage.
Point of a gun.
And to have a military advantage. Yeah. And while the White South generally had both of those things, that wasn't true in all places, right? So there were pockets of Virginia where the blacks outnumbered the whites. There were pockets of South Carolina. And the way that those people, those states would put down their slave revolts would be to have the well-regulated militia come in, very Roman style, and put down the slave revolt, right?
So can I stop you right there real quick? Just sure. so we could just, you know, because I know some folks out there right now and their heads are spinning. Because so what you're saying is that the Second Amendment was more about putting down potential slave revolts than it was protecting against the British and forces that would harm the interest of the United States.
Yes, that's why they wanted the Second Amendment, right? That's what
that sounds like some CRT-ish to me. I don't know, brother. I don't 1619. Well, you know,
in the book, I'm not quoting black people. I am quoting George Mason and Patrick Henry.
Right? No, I'm agreeing with you, by the way. But I'm just saying.
I know what people are saying, right? You know, so people. This is what George Mason, governor of Virginia at the time, said, that the North detests slavery, and that if they are left to discipline, that's the word that they use discipline, for arm, their militias, that they will not let the militia work against the slave revolts because they don't like slavery. So that's why we need a Second Amendment. Now, Michael, you can argue to me, and I would be amenable to this argument, that the Second Amendment has evolved from that original understanding to now encompass a more general right to self-defense. I am amenable to the argument that the Second Amendment means more now than what it did then. But if you're going to say that the Second Amendment has evolved in terms of why it's here, then surely it has also evolved into terms of what kinds of weapons it allows you to have.
Oh, there it is, my friend. Right? Absolutely.
All right, so Eighth Amendment. So to me, the Eighth Amendment is the cleanest battle to be had between originalists and progressives about constitutional interpretation, because the line says cruel and unusual punishment. We don't know what that means. That's ambiguous on its face, right? The Constitution doesn't define cruel. It doesn't define unusual, right? In fact, the founding fathers didn't even write that. They cut and paste, that is copy pasta from the English Bill of Rights in the 17th century that they just brought into the 18th century, right? So what do we do with this ambiguity? Well, conservatives and originalists say that we should go back and look at what the founding fathers thought were cruel and unusual, and that we will find that the founding fathers were entirely pro capital punishment. Every single state had capital punishment both before and after the adoption of the Eighth Amendment. The federal government had capital punishment both before and after the adoption of the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment, clearly, whatever it means, it doesn't mean that capital punishment is illegal, is unconstitutional, if we just look at what the people who wrote it did. And I say, I don't care. I just straight up do not care what Thomas Jefferson thought was cruel and unusual, because Thomas Jefferson was a rapist slaveholder. And so his definition of what was cruel is not something that I'm going to consult when I think about what's cruel today. What these people did and were willing to do to these slaves at the founding kind of takes away their moral standing to tell me how to interpret cruel and unusual. And it's entirely, that's entirely consistent with a modern view of the Constitution. Remember, the death penalty was already ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1972.
Yes.
We've already had this debate. Now, it was overturned in 1976 because they came up with basically a new way that they could argue was less cruel than before. And that's where this debate is always around. I think the insanity about this death penalty debate is that it's always around the most or least cruel way to kill a person. You could just not kill a person. That's also possible.
That's an option.
But I've made this point, Michael, and I make it in the book that people on my side, especially who are generally anti-death penalty, need to be careful about how this argument rolls, because I think too often people on my side act like being anti-death penalty is the clearly morally superior argument, and I just want to be cautious about that, because put it like this: at every point in human history, people have been killing other people who committed crimes, right? Like that's what they did in Assyria, that's what they did in Athens, that's what they did in medieval Europe, that's what they did in Rome, and that's certainly what they did here, and that's certainly what they still do in most places around the world. Because sometimes the people that we're talking about often have committed terrible crimes, right? So I try not to be on my moral high horse when I'm anti-death penalty. I try to stay very close to my legal roots when I'm anti-death penalty. My problem with the death penalty does not flow from a moral position, although I do think personally that it's morally wrong. It flows from the position that the government is not good enough at knowing who did wrong and why, is not good enough at applying this fairly to all people to be empowered to kill people. Right.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. In fact, you say in that portion of the book, it's not unusual to be cruel. Quote, to oppose the death penalty on moral grounds is to deny two of the most fundamental human emotions, fear and revenge. I would take slight exception to that by saying, as someone who is intimately involved in my own evolution, obviously, on this subject, that the moral grounds actually is a very important part of the fear and the revenge piece. You can't get away from that. What the moral grounds is, it's a check. It's a check on the fear and revenge impulse. Because I remember when my aunt was horrifically killed in her apartment in New York, the revenge was strong. Like, it's like the force. It is strong within you, right? But the moral compass had to refocus that energy. And so there is, I think, a very delicate balance there. You're absolutely right. You cannot stand exclusively on the moral piece, because these other things will pull you, and then you're in contradiction of your own system, belief system. No, last thing, and you're out of here. Just what real quick
is the other emotion that I don't write about is grace.
Yes,
grace is also a human emotion, and you can there's the possibility of thinking about law and thinking about certainly criminal justice with an eye towards grace.
But I've had enough white people tell me I should be graceful. I just go blow past that whole grace thing. So if you want to have a discussion with me, though, you don't start it with, you should be graceful.
I mean, look, I didn't write about it. I'm just saying.
I totally get you. Supreme Court, real quick, since we've been talking about the court in essence and how they come up with these things, 53-47 looks like the final vote is going to be. When it comes down, we're going to have the first Black woman on the court.
I just want to just for your, I called 53 votes as soon as she was nominated. I called 53 votes, and I called that we were going to switch Graham from Romney. Like
I did call the Romney piece too. I thought we'd get one more. I thought it was going to be 54. I thought there would have been one more vote there. But you know, I guess my boy Tim Scott just doesn't appreciate the moment. But
no, you weren't going to get Tim Scott without shot. If you got Tim Scott, you were going to get Graham.
Right.
That was going to, that was a different nominee. Just to nerd out on politics a little bit. There is a version of this world where Tom Tillis is better than he is. Like there are bits of Tom Tillis that you can see he wants to be better than he is. He just can't, just won't let him somehow.
A lot of them do. A lot of them do, Ellie. A lot of them.
I want to free Tom Tillis at some point. Right?
I think Tom Tillis, I think he's going to free himself.
The reason why I'm not surprised by this is because she was overwhelmingly qualified. It's like when Biden said that he was going to nominate the first Black woman in the Supreme Court, I was kind of like, yeah, bro, all of them will, because Ketanji Brown Jackson was that good. Like, she should have been nominated. It was one of Barack Obama's mistakes, I think, to nominate Garland as opposed to Jackson back in 2016. I think that would have changed the debate around that obstruction a whole different way, right? She was incredibly qualified. Just the last point here, one of the things that I don't understand about your side is that they'll make arguments that they know are not winning arguments, right? The Josh Hawley pedophile argument, that was never going to work. That was always towards a very small section.
It did work. See, that's the problem. You think, a lot of folks think that this is for general broad audience consumption. It is not. When I'm sitting at the dais as Josh Hawley, I'm talking to two people. Folks who are going to appreciate what I'm about to say about pedophiles, meaning they're going to get all fired up about it and angry and start looking at her as a pedophile protector. And the person's going to write me a check. That's it. And it is, there's no way Josh Hawley looks at, Lindsey Graham, I get it. Oh yeah, well, she's not from South Carolina, so I hate her. Okay, well, that's dumb, but all right, we'll go with that. The reality of it is, all of these folks found the excuse that works for the very narrow sliver of interest that they have. This was not about putting the best person on the court or anything like that. This was about the fact that I could score the political points I need to score and raise some cash off of it. There we are. Well, uncomplicated.
At the end of the day, all I can say is that the Ketanji Brown Jackson will ascend to the Supreme Court as the most popular nominee since John Roberts.
I'm not only going to agree with that, I'm going to take it one step further. I'm going to say she's going to have a profound impact on that court in such a way that some of those conservatives, and we can have this discussion at another time, because I firmly believe there's more wiggle room on the right than a lot of people believe there is on a number of issues. And I think Justice Brown Jackson will change in the minority position, will change the thinking on some of these justices, on some of these arguments. I'm looking at, coming down the line, the civil rights cases, the affirmative action cases and things like that. I'm not saying that it's going to go to 5-4. It still may be 6-3, but I think what you're going to hear and see over time is her influence on this court in a way that I don't think people fully appreciate right now.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I can go that far. I don't have that much hope, my friend. But
I'm a hopeful brother. What can I say?
I'll be watching her career with great interest, as they say in Star Wars. But I also will be watching, and this is just kind of for your outtakes. I'll be watching Amy Coney Barrett. I think that she has, I completely disagree with how she got on the court. I thought the process of putting her on the court in that rushed way.
Right.
Was not good and was not something that I can support. However, she has shown herself to be one of the best questioners, and people don't always hear this. She has been one of the best questioners so far in her short time on it. And she has shown an intellectual flexibility that I don't know that a lot of people thought she had. I think she's gonna do what she was sent there to do. She's gonna take away abortion. She's gonna liberalize gun, like she's gonna do what she was sent there to do, but on some of the issues around at the margins, I think it'll be interesting to see.
I think that's going to be an interesting tag team, those two. I think Coney Barrett and Brown Jackson are going to be an interesting pair of justices to watch, because I think you're going to see them agreeing more than they disagree.
I don't know more than they disagree, but I think they're going to agree more than people think they will.
Right. How about that? Okay, that's fair. That's fair. And with that, we're going to let Ellie get back to selling this wonderful book. It is called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Folks, it's out now. Ellie Mistal is one of the great philosopher thinkers, as well as pragmatic applicators of the law to the facts, and helping us understand some of the crazy ish that we see day in and day out. Certainly you can follow Ellie on Twitter at Ellie NYC. That's ELIENYC. You'll catch him on MSNBC as a political analyst and a frequent guest. And again, Ellie's got a great one out there, folks. Ellie, I'm so glad you could take time to be with us, man. I really
do. Thank you for having Michael, and thank you for the great conversation. It was it's nice to kind of get into some of the actually controversial things that I say in the book, because the Constitution is not good is actually not the controversial part. It's page two.
Right, it's not. It really isn't. But it's a great tease, folks. It's a great tease. You had me at unfair, right? So, all right, folks. Next time, be safe, be well, take care. You can find us on the Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. Don't forget to like this episode. We love it when you do. And, you know, comment on it as well on the Spreaker app, because when you do, it helps me improve my game. And I'm always about doing that. Until next time, be well.
Right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family, and once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.